Are you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hello there. Welcome back to another episode of Mind Body Peak Performance. If you've wondered about the gut, what is it? Why does it matter? And how to optimize it? This is the show for you. I hunted down an expert on all things gut health. Her name is Trish Whetstone. Trish is the feel-good gut coach, a holistic health specialist, stress expert, and intuitive eating advocate. She became a certified coach to help herself after years of struggling with IBS, and now she helps others through nutrition, stress management, and lifestyle change so they can feel good in their gut. She's a co-host of the podcast Ice Cream You Scream and a prolific Instagrammer at Feel Good Gut Girl. In my conversation with Trish, we talk about things such as when you go to the doctor and you feel terrible but are told that you're normal, how the gut is connected to the brain, the link between the vagus nerve and gut health, how leaky gut inflames the brain, how you can kick sugar cravings, why excessive worrying over your food choices can be worse than the occasional junk meal, situations in which probiotics may make things worse, some of her top tips to a thriving gut microbiome, just how long some produce takes to go from harvest to your shopping cart, absorbing more nutrients from your meals through a process we call meditative eating, and lastly, an easy way to reduce late-night snacking. Grab your digital notebooks and let's dive in. We're here today with Feel Good Gut Coach, Trish Whetstone. Trish, what are some of the unusual things, habits, products, et cetera, that you've done so far for your health and performance today?
Yeah, one of the things that I have started doing in the mornings, and I have to say, I got this from the book Atomic Habits by James Clear. I didn't make this up myself, is using a little visual to track my to-dos for the day. So I have two different things on my desk here, paper clips in one and then an empty jar next to it, and kind of transferring over the paper clips when I complete my to-do list. So I kind of fill it up with the things that I at least know I have to get done. It's so simple, but because I'm a visual person, it actually has really helped me and given me that like little burst of dopamine, like, oh my gosh, I got five things done already today. It's kind of like a little to-do list, but I've really liked implementing that to my mornings. And then another thing I started doing, and this, it might not be that unusual, but for me, it was unusual, is I've always been a journaler, but I started writing poetry. I'm going to say quote unquote poetry here in the mornings. Instead of like writing in full sentences, I liked that it was kind of bulleted and kind of helps me process some emotions and thoughts in like a complete little way. Like, okay, what am I feeling today? Let me title my poem this and then just go through it. And it's a way in which I can be a little bit creative. So I really like doing that with my mornings, actually.
It's a good creative flair to start the day. And do you ever go back through your old entries and get some inspiration or check out what your previous entries were?
Yes, I actually have done that. And sometimes I'm like, oh, okay, a little cringe. But then sometimes it's like, no, actually, I really loved that I said that. And like, wow, I'm surprised those words kind of flowed out of me. It's interesting. So I do that sometimes.
It's like a little time capsule of where you were then versus now.
Yes, exactly.
So how'd you get started as a gut coach, interested in gut health in general? Like, what's your backstory?
Yeah, so I honestly had a pretty healthy childhood and teen years. And I studied psychology and public health in college. So I always had an interest in health and was a health conscious individual. And it was during those college years that I started to develop my own health issues. Like all of a sudden I started to have digestive upset and my energy was really low, even though I was really active and fit and my nutrition was all right. It wasn't like it is now, but I was generally pretty health conscious. So I knew something else had to be going on underneath the surface. So I started to see some specialists, and they kind of gave me the vague diagnosis of IBS. And honestly, my gastro was like, most young women have IBS. Just, yeah, kind of deal with it. You're not like a, you know, someone who's really high risk with Crohn's. And I didn't want to accept that because I was like, I was working at a restaurant, long hours. I was a student. I had an internship, and I would wake up feeling like I got hit by a bus. Like I was just, my joints were sore. I had the brain fog. I had the digestive upset. I was starting to lose weight, but I actually was like, my pant size were increasing just because of my bloat. And I just knew this wasn't right. So I started to do a lot of personal research on gut health, kind of realized all of this was connected to the gut, not just the digestion, but some skin issues and the joint pain and things like that. And then on a whim, I found a health coaching program online on an Instagram ad of all places, Health Coach Institute. And I decided to join to help myself first. I was like, I like that this is holistic. I like that it's really, you know, personally based with coaching. It's very personal. And I absolutely loved it. I kind of used myself. I was my first client on this journey and just saw a huge improvement when I looked at health from this holistic person-centered stance. And then from there, I decided to really specialize in gut health because I want to help others who've been in situations like me.
There's no worse feeling than knowing you feel terrible and then going in thinking you're going to get your answers and the test coming back saying, oh no, you're totally normal.
Yes, exactly. It's so disappointing. And I think you really hit the nail on the head there. It's like, I had a lot of hope, like, I'm going to get my answers. And it really was a process. And I will say gut health is nuanced. It's a process, but that's why I loved this really research-driven, holistic approach with coaching. Cause it's like, let's look at all facets of life here. We know this isn't normal. We just maybe need to do a little bit more digging, right? Whereas medical field does a lot of tests and it's like, yes, no answer. You're good, right?
But your background before that isn't just on gut health. You have a background in psychology and habit change.
Yes, exactly. So I studied habit change and psychology and neuroscience in college. So I was always really interested in the brain and behavior and things like that. And so it was really interesting. And I was interested in health as well, but it was very interesting when I learned that the gut was connected to mental health. So it was like, oh my gosh, what an interesting world. And I still think I use my psychology background and my coaching, and it makes a lot of sense. It really, there is a connection there.
Let's talk more about that. Tell me about how the gut is connected to the mind and brain.
Yeah, exactly. So we have our central nervous system, which is our brain and our spinal cord. And when we think of the nervous system, oftentimes we just think of that. But our gut, the lining of our gastrointestinal tract, actually has a nervous system as well called the enteric nervous system. And there are neurons that fire there. And this nervous system, the gut, is connected directly to the vein via the vagus nerve, which is our 10th cranial nerve. And it's bidirectional. It's like a bidirectional highway. Our brain sends signals down to our gut sends signals up to our brain, but there actually is more nerves firing upstream from the gut to the brain. So this is really important because it shows that gut health really does affect our mental health. And a lot of this is chemical. A lot of this has to do with neurotransmitters. About 90% of our serotonin, our feel-good neurotransmitter involved in mood and sleep, is actually created within our gut, not just within our brain. So there is this amazing influence of the gut on the brain, but then also any mental, emotional stress we're experiencing in our brain affects our gut health as well.
That's an incredible concept to ponder, the fact that there's neurons, not just in the brain, but in the gut as well.
Yes, exactly. And so like, it kind of, if you've ever had that gut feeling, the butterflies in the stomach, deep drop in the gut, if it's something serious, or just even like, I know that when I started practicing deep breathing, I could actually feel a lot of sensation in my gut, even if it's like calming sensation and things like that. And it makes a lot of sense. Like there's neurons firing here. Our brain is just so loud. Our conscious brain and even our subconscious brain sends us thoughts. So we really think that so much of our emotion and our sensation stuff is controlled up here, but it's not. A lot of it's in the gut as well.
You said that that process of information transfer from the gut to the brain and the brain to the gut goes through the vagus nerve.
Yes.
What does the vagus nerve do? How can we improve it? Is that important in gut health?
Oh, it absolutely is. And I love this because this is kind of a newer area of research. But the vagus nerve is basically connected to almost all of our organs, so like our heart, our lungs, of course, our stomach and our colon, our digestive tract is kind of all affected. There's branches off of the vagus nerve here. So the vagus nerve does help control things like our heart rate and our breathing, and of course, the motility of our gut. So a lot of times we think we eat food, it just goes through the system and it's automatically digested. That's not necessarily the case if we have poor vagal tone. So it's actually, research shows that about 75 to maybe 80% of people who have IBS and SIBO or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth actually have low vagal tone. So this vagus nerve isn't activated or utilized as well. So it's not literally propelling this process of motility of food going through the gut in a very efficient fashion. And that's when we're stuck with like gas, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, like if it's too much or if it's too little and we're not absorbing our nutrients as well. And a lot of this is controlled by this vagus nerve, and it should be a very subconscious process. But part of what is happening in these situations is we're experiencing chronic stress, which affects the vagus nerve. So we're not focusing on deep breathing and a lot of these techniques for the vagus nerve. And I can elaborate on that, but I guess I'm curious if you have questions or thoughts before I elaborate.
Does the stress cause the vagus nerve to send no messages, bad messages, inaccurate messages?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I like to think that it's either no messages or inefficient messages. It's like, it's not, this process isn't kind of happening in an efficient fashion. So for example, what happens is we have two different sympathetic nervous system responses, parasympathetic, which is our rest and digest response. That's what we call it. That's essentially when we're relaxed, right? And then there's the sympathetic nervous response. And that is when we are in fight, flight, or freeze mode. We're ready to, you know, evolutionarily run away from the bear or fight it off, and we're stressed out. Essentially, the vagus nerve works really well and efficiently in this parasympathetic state. But so many of us in this day and age live in sympathetic too often, right? We're not running away from bears anymore, but we're stuck in traffic, or we have emails to attend to, or we got in a fight with a partner, and we're constantly living in that state. And essentially what happens is we're not really activating or utilizing the vagus nerve as much because we're not living and tapping into this parasympathetic as much as we really should. That's where we heal. That is where this process of digestion, nutrient assimilation really happens.
If healing the vagus nerve is the best step, what's wrong with taking digestive aids, something that increases or decreases stomach acid, and using that quick fix rather than the vagus nerve itself?
I love that question. I think it's exactly what you said. It's a quick fix. It's almost typically like a Band-Aid. So a lot of the ways that those digestive aids work is it temporarily calms or decreases that amount of acid that's secreted. But what happens, especially with things like heartburn, is we're depressing that stomach acid so we don't get that heartburn. But actually, we really need stomach acid. We really need that, and it needs to be efficiently flowing. What happens when people have heartburn is we're like, it's too much acid all at once, it's causing pain, and it's not actually like a good consistent flow. So one, those things typically are a Band-Aid. When you stop using them, you're still going to get those issues if you're not working on a lot of these lifestyle factors that stimulate this vagus nerve: exercise, deep breathing, proper nutrition to get things flowing, stress management techniques. And research does find that a lot of these things like proton pump inhibitors that help manage this acid over time can do more harm than good, because your body kind of gets used to it. It becomes like a crutch, as it were. And then again, without it, we might actually be left with a worse environment of acid and gut bacteria that we really want to be very balanced.
It's almost like using a big hammer to pound in a nail. And if you blunt stomach acid too much, then you're allowing bacteria to thrive and grow and proliferate in your gut that wouldn't otherwise. And on the opposite end, if you have too much acid and you knock it back, you're creating other problems.
Yeah, that's a really good way of describing it. I like that visual of the hammer. You go way too hard and then you end up denting the wall, right?
Exactly.
just putting the nail in. Yeah, that's a good one.
What would an unhealthy gut due to a brain?
Yes. Yeah. So we already talked about kind of that chemical, that neurotransmitter output. So for example, if the brain is not processing and functioning efficiently, we're not going to be outputting enough serotonin, dopamine, which is positive reward, melatonin, which helps with sleep. So then we're left with things like brain fog, lack of mental clarity, actual anxiety and depression, regardless of whether people have digestive concerns, have been linked to poor gut health. And the other side of this coin here is the health of our gut microbiome. So our microbiome are all these microbes or bugs. You know, it is bacteria, viruses, and fungi that live in hopefully a symbiotic relationship here. There's some good, there's some bad, but hopefully we have enough good to combat the bad bacteria here. We need bacteria and microbes. But a lot of times what happens when we start to develop gut issues is we have too much bad bacteria, not enough good bacteria being produced. And one of the things structurally that can happen in the gut is something called leaky gut. Now, this isn't like totally diagnosable yet, but it's still accepted in the health and the medical community as something that happens. And basically, there's too much intestinal permeability. So there isn't these tight junctions at the site of our intestines, and food molecules and bacteria can be released into the bloodstream. That bloodstream or that that process can then go up to the brain and get into the blood-brain barrier, past the blood-brain barrier, and we can have unhealthy bacteria then being harbored within our brain. It's no surprise then that we would experience anxiety, low energy, sleep issues, mental clarity, a lot of these things, of course, that are so, should be really efficiently processed within our brain.
Would there be inflammation as well, which is the root of all disease?
Exactly. I'm so glad you brought it up. Thank you for articulating what I couldn't. Essentially, this process is inflammation. Inflammation is the root of all disease. And essentially, if you take one thing away from this, inflammation is happening in your gut. And then inflammation essentially travels to other areas of your body, like your brain.
If I suspect that I'm either having a leaky gut or gut issues in general, are there any other symptoms that I would notice aside from the mental side of things?
Yes, exactly. I think that is a really good point, because besides just mental side of things and digestive concerns, things like bloat and that nature, a lot of times people do have joint pain or skin issues. So things like acne or psoriasis, a lot of eczema and psoriasis are linked to leaky gut, and people might not even have digestive concerns. People might have these mental health concerns like brain fog, but again, not have some of these other symptoms. Again, joint pain. About 80 to 90% of our immune system is housed in our gut. So if you're having allergens, like just sinus issues, or you're getting a lot of coughs and colds and other illnesses, it's likely that there is this leaky gut at the core. Another huge one is weight. A lot of times it's inability to keep weight off. You're gaining a lot of weight, or inability to put weight on. So weight issues are also linked to this as well. And the last one is general issues with blood sugar. So much of our blood sugar is regulated in our gut. So if you have those really, really strong sugar cravings, or you're actually developing type 2 diabetes, a lot of research is pointing this back to leaky gut and this unhealthy gut microbiome.
Do you recommend to cut out sugar? Is that the right approach? Or is it to like wean yourself off, or something different altogether?
You know what? That's a really good question. I would say sugar is one of the biggest triggers for the gut. It absolutely is. And our health in general. We don't really need added sugars. But what I like to think is I would work with my clients one-on-one and see. Some people do really well with quitting it cold turkey. The end goal will be getting rid of most, if not all, processed or added sugars, at least for a period of time. But if you need to make a transition, and let's say we stop added sugars, but we're still using honey and maple syrup a lot, they're healthier. They, they have health benefits and things, but they're still sugar, right? And maybe carby vegetables and fruits and things like that. And it's going to be a spectrum. Some people really need to maybe limit even carby veggies and fruit for some time while they heal their gut. Some people can still have all those fibrous carbs and sugars, but just not the processed sugars. So it's almost like finding a process that works for you. The end goal is at least, none of those added sugars, and lessening the overall amount of sugar and carbs that we have, at least to some extent.
Does that process look like
trying something different, seeing how you feel after a couple of days and then repeating?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to be honest. A lot of people don't want to hear this, but I do advise against this process of trial and error and maybe using a food journal. It's work, but this is really our best data comes from our body, not even a food sensitivity test. The best thing you can do is try it out at least for a few days, commit to a week, maybe 2 weeks for things like gluten or dairy, and then add it back in, see how you feel. You're going to experience these symptoms in higher volume or more intensity when you get rid of it. Like, for example, when I first had these issues, people were like, maybe it's gluten intolerance. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. I eat bread every single day. And then when I stopped eating bread every single day and I reintroduced it, it was like, oh yeah, hit me like a ton of bricks. Totally makes sense, right?
I've had the same experience with a bunch of different foods, and I thought it couldn't be this group of foods because I have it every day. Then I cut it out and come back to it. It's like, oh, I'm tired an hour after I eat it. I feel bad.
Brain fog is there. And you know what? A lot of times, that's a good point. A lot of times it's the foods you have the most. Let's say, like, if you never eat avocado and then you eat avocado and you're like, have a little bit on a scale of 1 to 10, maybe you have a bloat of 3 or 5. It's likely not that you have to completely avoid it. Some foods you might just have to kind of get used to. But if it's higher on the scale, if it's totally consistent every time you eat it, then definitely that's how you can determine a true food sensitivity for yourself.
When you mention that, it makes me think of avocados being high in histamine and some people having histamine sensitivity. And if you are working on your gut health, what's the interlink between food sensitivity and your gut?
Yeah, food sensitivity in your gut. So typically there is going to be foods that people need to avoid and they're likely going to be sensitive to. And basically what this is it differs than an allergy because there might not be an immediate immune response. Like you might not break out in hives or, you know, go into anaphylactic shock like an allergen, but a food sensitivity is something that just does not settle well with your gut. And essentially it's not processed by the gut well. So some of the biggest ones for gut health are gluten, dairy, and sugar. Those added sugars. And we call that fructose intolerance. I think there's a true spectrum for all of these things. Some people can be very lactose intolerant or just have to avoid dairy altogether. Some people just really have to lessen it, can take lactase enzymes. Some things like gluten oftentimes have to be excluded. And then there are these other categories. I would say I typically advise people look at those top three first. Then, as you mentioned, histamine intolerance can definitely be a thing. It's a little bit less common and it's so restrictive. So I tell people, don't jump to conclusions right there. You're going to restrict yourself. But if you're finding that, you know, fermented foods that are actually supposed to be very good for the gut, like kimchi, sauerkraut, yogurt, are affecting you, then maybe look at that histamine thing. So it's kind of a process, but it is very worth it. There is this link between gut issues and food sensitivities for sure.
For a while, I fermented my own kombucha and made it, I guess. And I was having big jars of it every day, multiple times a day. I thought it was a health food and that you can't ever have too much of a health food. And I quickly realized that that was the wrong line of thinking.
Yeah. And you know what? I think this is a really great point is like even health foods we can have too much of. I think that one of the other gut health diets that you may have heard of is a low FODMAP diet. And it's very restrictive. And hopefully the idea here, I would recommend that people don't stay on that forever. It's usually a short period of time or shorter in the grand scheme of your life, even if you're on it for a couple months. The idea is that you add those foods back in. But I think one of the main lessons with the low FODMAP diet is that you can overdo it with foods. Again, avocado, you maybe can't eat a whole avocado in one sitting, but your whole life, just cut your avocados in half, right? And maybe you can tolerate it. So I think that that is a really good point. Some foods just become sensitive when you have so much of it, right?
Yeah. And that's also a good point that the sensitivity is on a spectrum.
Yes.
And now when I have kombucha, it's no problem. There's actually a company that I'm testing out their device. It's called Food Marble. And I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's a little device and you breathe into it after you eat and it measures the amount of hydrogen in your breath. And from that, they can tell what foods you're sensitive to. And
yes.
So if you're a little more on the nerd side of things and want data and self-quantification, there's that device.
If you want to get that data yourself. That's so awesome. I didn't know that there was a home device for that. I know that you can test for that like in office with clinicians. So that is so cool. That's awesome. Yeah, I think we've already touched on this, but it's the it is the perspective that it is this way or the highway. Like it's totally like there are some perspectives out there that raw veganism is the only way because it's so high in fiber, right? And then some people do the carnivore diet, which is just meats and no vegetables. And I'm like, I really wouldn't advise on the extreme ends of these diets or taking in something and some sort of data as the end all be all or complete truth, because there is a process, there is an extent, there is a spectrum. So I think some people like, one time I did have dairy and it messed me up, I will completely avoid it. For some people that's totally fine, but you might find that you can have lower lactate cheeses, you know? So basically like these polar extremes of dieting kind of make my blood boil and too little variety. Ultimately, I think we get in this perspective that I need to restrict, but then we're so undernourished and that can actually affect this motility that we're talking about in the gut, like the vagus nerve. The gut can kind of go on like emergency mode, like I don't have enough nutrients. So you need to start adding some big things back in. So ultimately, kind of having this perspective, there might be some foods I do truly avoid. And then there's some that are over time I can add back in, knowing that really variety is going to be the ultimate goal. We want more variety of plant-based foods and different types of meats that actually feeds the microbiome. So kind of, I guess the main myth or misconception here is that it's restriction all the time forever.
What all successful diets have in common is that they remove the processed foods, they limit the crappy processed oils. There's both ends of the spectrum, and for most people, what's going to work best for them probably is in the middle. Yes. Not to say that it doesn't work great for people on either end.
Exactly. That was a perfect way to put it. You're probably going to be in the middle. And in general, as a rule, you know exactly whether it's paleo or veganism, you're getting rid of the processed crap, the inflammatory oils, the added sugars and things of that nature. And I guess the other thing is, I really like to advise against people becoming too stressed over their food, because I think there's diet culture when it comes to weight loss, and weight loss may or may not also be a part of your gut health journey, but there are these people who aren't even like in this diet culture of weight loss, but they're in this diet culture of gut health, and you actually develop this unhealthy relationship with food, like looking at all food as stressful and bad. And I really want people to kind of come out of it like, no, actually I'm nourishing my body. I'm just finding what works, and food isn't necessarily the enemy here. It's going to be your biggest tool in healing for sure.
That's something that I mention all the time, is that you might be getting the highest quality food, it might be biodynamic, organic, fair trade, but if you have a full-blown panic attack, if you go out to a restaurant and it's anything less than that, that panic attack is going to offset so much of the hard work you've done in getting clean food.
Yes, exactly. You know what? That'll be one of my, I want to touch on that a little bit more when it comes to like my best recommendations, because I love that. That is so, so true. And I think just to kind of sum up, the last thing that I think is something to look out for, kind of a myth when it comes to gut health, is that probiotics or supplements are the end all be all and the cure all. They may or may not be part of your journey. Yes, probiotics facilitate that good bacteria, but if you have a bacteria issue, like with small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, it might actually upset things for a while, right? Those fermented foods like kombucha might actually not be the cure all for you. It might not work or settle well with you. And ultimately, you can use a supplement. It can help with healing on a structural or chemical level. But if you take that away and you don't ever change your lifestyle, like you don't adopt healthy nutrition or stress management techniques, then they're just going to come back. That bacteria is going to grow. That stressful environment is going to foster these things. Again, it may or may not be part of it, but it doesn't really address the true root cause, which is lifestyle typically.
Before we get to your best recommendations and things that you recommend people employ immediately,
sure.
How do you go about getting more species, more variety in your diet? Because I read somewhere a long time ago that the number of different species in the average supermarket is astoundingly low. And when I took inventory of what I was eating, I realized that although it's like these 10 different vegetable products, they all come from the same family and they're actually very closely related, and there wasn't as much diversity as I thought I was eating.
Yes, that's such a good point. I think that one of the ways that people can do this is eating seasonally. because again, if we're just going to the supermarket year round, you can get apples, but I mean, here in Ohio and New York, apples aren't actually in season until the fall. So eat what is in season, because your body's going to naturally adjust to that. It's likely going to be closer to organic, or like you said, fair trade, or it's going to be higher quality if you're eating from a farmer's market and things like that. You're going to have more nutrition in those organic produce that were made on the farm around the corner than the grocery store that were shipped overseas. And I think I really get what you're saying, that our grocery stores typically don't have it. But I typically advise people to like try one new food every week or a month if you can. Like, I've never, even if this is tough for you, or you don't have as much variety, like try the dragon fruit, frozen dragon fruit, and put it in your smoothie, right? That's never going to hurt. To have that greater variety and try something new versus, like you said, I eat apples, oranges, carrots, spinach, kale, but it's like the same produce all year round, you know? So try something new and eat seasonally. I think that would be my best recommendation.
That's a great recommendation, especially because after the produce is harvested, the nutritional content of it starts to drop off. And I was blown away that sometimes it can be a full year between the harvesting of a, say, an apple, and it ending up in your shopping cart, an entire year.
That is unbelievable. I never heard that specifically. That's actually amazing. And so I typically like don't shy away from frozen fruits and vegetables. They're typically picked at the peak of freshness and at least put in there. And a lot of their nutrition is actually maintained versus fresh fruits and vegetables. So don't shy away from that. That's one of the ways to get some more peak nutrition.
I always have frozen fruits and veggies in my freezer because of that.
It's like cheaper, right? And they last longer. So like you actually are ticking off a couple of boxes here. It's more beneficial than just the nutrition here. It's convenient, right?
Yeah. And the whole concept of eating in season isn't anything new. It's been around for at least 5,000 years in the old ancient Ayurvedic texts. Mm-hmm. And then also the more recent research is finding that the enzymes and different things in your body fluctuate in accordance with the seasons. You might break down bread, gluten, much more effectively in the fall than you would in the winter. And if you're breaking it down more effectively, your blood sugar not going to spike as high as it would otherwise.
I have read a little bit about that. Isn't that so fascinating? It's fascinating and it's surprising because we just aren't intentional about these things, but it makes so much sense. Like when we come back to how things would be, like I only eat this food because it's only available to me before processed foods and industrialization in this season, like your body adapts. It makes a lot of sense actually. So come back to those things. Some things I do tell people is like, if you are nodding your head kind of, oh, duh, that makes sense. Follow that rule. Like it doesn't mean like, oh, duh, that makes sense. Oh, that's not important. No, actually, probably it's really important. Even if it seems simple, that means that you should pay attention to that.
Just because there isn't research there yet doesn't mean there won't be. Like if you look at antibiotics, when they first came out, they were given around like candy for everything, for a runny nose, for a headache.
Antibiotics are a huge causal factor here. And we know our gut is linked to so much other areas of our health. And I think that is something that, yes, you can control to an extent and really look out for that, right? Don't overuse antibiotics. And it is a really good example of something that at one point seemed like the main solution, like this is fantastic. There was a catch-all here, right?
Whenever there's a easy shortcut, a hack, if you will, we have to be extra alert, extra vigilant, make sure that the hack actually is only what it is and not more.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
So what are some of the other things aside from eating in season? That's a huge one. Oh, that's probably the lowest hanging fruit. What are some other gut health tips you have?
Yeah. So I love to encourage people to tap into the cephalic phase of digestion. And this is what you were touching base with when it came to that panic attack. Cephalic means head. So actually 20% of our stomach acid is secreted if we are touching into this, if we are eating mindfully before that food even gets to our stomach. So this is eating what I say centrally. And basically that just means with our senses. So looking at our plate, appreciating it, actually taking the time to arrange our plate in a visually pleasing way, smell your food, maybe say a prayer before it. You know, when you are eating, chew your food really slowly. Most people chew each bite of food like 3 to 5 times before swallowing, and we're missing the mechanics of our mouth, and chemically in our saliva, we have digestive enzymes. So if you can chew 20 to 30 times each bite of food before you swallow, practice a longer, slower, more mindful meal, about 20 minutes rather than 5 minutes on the go, you're going to be really helping facilitate the digestion within the mouth, within the head, before it even gets to the gut. Again, it's mechanical, it's chemical. You'll release some neurotransmitters to be more relaxed, to be in parasympathetic, rather than when we are rushing. Even if we don't feel stressed, our body, when we're moving fast, is going to be more in that sympathetic state. So we're going to be more stressed out. So I always like to say, it doesn't matter if you're eating the healthiest kale salad or a piece of pizza, if you don't eat it mindfully, you're actually passing over this cephalic phase of digestion. And I have to say, it is huge. If you are eating healthy in general, you know, not processed, more clean, and you are still having gut issues, this is the first thing I tell people. Like, don't even change anything. Just do this and see if you notice a difference in your bloat, your heartburn, your gut health, kind of just in a couple of days, and see what happens. You'll probably be pleasantly surprised.
Interesting you mentioned that. I, about a year ago, realized that it's better for me if I can't sit down and relax before I eat, just not to eat at all. I'll continue fasting. If I'm in the sympathetic state, that food's not going to be digested and the nutrients aren't going to be assimilated like they should. Mm-hmm. So I've been very aware of that, probably a little too much, where I'm letting it worry me if I do eat on the move.
Yeah.
And then also about eating in the parasympathetic state. In this house, we always will take a minute before we start eating. I wouldn't necessarily call it a prayer, but we'll grab hands and just savor the moment, close our eyes, think about like what we're doing, what we're enjoying together, the effort and work that went into preparing the food. Mm-hmm. And it went from like a thing that people were laughing at first. And now when they go out and have food with their friends, they pass it on. And so it's like started a little chain like that.
That is so fantastic. That is just the coolest thing, because I have never heard of someone really implementing that within their friend group. So I have to hand it to you. And I think again, this goes back to things that you probably were told from a kid. Chew your food. Put your fork down, right? Savor your food. Actually enjoy it. Let's give thanks for our food beforehand. There is actually some science here, psychologically and physiologically. It basically gets your body ready for food. We weren't intended to eat while driving and, you know, in a meeting and just on the go. We really weren't. This is really kind of tapping into how things should be again.
Part of what makes that hard for me originally is that as a kid, I was rebellious. So if I was told to chew 30 times, I would chew 3 times.
Yes. So many of us, this is our tendency. I am a fast eater. This is something I continually have to remind myself of. And it's so easy to do things on the go. And it's so easy to want to be distracted while we're eating. And it's something that we do take for granted. But I also like to say, this is kind of hitting two birds with one stone as well. A lot of times when I talk to clients, they're like, I can't eat healthy and manage my stress and be mindful. And it's like, this is maybe if this is the only time you quote unquote meditate and breathe between your bites and you're slowing down, you have to eat anyway. You might as well do it during your meal and have a little bit of stress management mindfulness time.
And there's so many other ways. I started using smaller utensils, smaller serving dishes, putting my fork down in between bites, which was taking a lot of retraining.
Yes. And I love that, because you are retraining your brain. And then over time, this is going to have a huge impact. And that's the other main thing, is that this process of slowing down, likely you'll eat less, but those other cues of smaller utensils and plates are huge. And I think that was a huge lesson for me, because I was someone who always was active and basically had a great metabolism. I didn't gain weight, but I didn't realize I was a constant overeater. I was a chronic overeater. I ate so much because I was always thin and was like, I want to put some meat on my bones. And I didn't realize, although I wasn't gaining weight, it was just all impacting my gut. Overeating can impact digestion. That motility doesn't happen when we're constantly feeding it. So I'm glad you brought that up.
I get that too, because I was always the same way for rugby and football, trying to pack on weight, gain 30, 40 pounds. And you can't gain that kind of weight easily without shoveling of food in your mouth.
Exactly.
And I retrained my stomach to expect that huge load. And it's taken fasting and different things to reset my hunger hormones.
Yes. And you know what? That was actually going to be my next recommendation, is to do some sort of fasting. Fasting is beneficial for the gut, but I tell people they don't necessarily have to do intermittent fasting. In the very least, take advantage of our natural fast, which should be when we're sleeping. So try and not eat at least 2 hours before bedtime. Late night snacking is huge when it comes to digestive issues. And then giving yourself a little bit of time. If you are hungry in the morning, then stop eating later at night. Try and avoid that. Move your dinner time earlier to 5 or 6 p.m. rather than 7. If you are someone who doesn't need that fuel in the morning, I think this is very much listening to your body. Then you can see if you can push breakfast back. But I think overeating and not giving ourselves this natural time to fast, like you said, our hormones reset when we sleep, our hunger and our fullness hormones reset. And if we're doing that late at night, then we're going to wake up with those carby, sugary cravings. We absolutely are. So this is a huge one for gut health. And again, something that you can do hopefully pretty easily. Try and do it in increments. If you are a late night eater, like I was, I kind of had to try like a half hour at a time until I got to a much better place.
There's a lot around meal timing as well.
Yes.
And according to Ayurveda also, that meat shouldn't be consumed in large quantities in the evening because it ferments, putrefies in the gut.
Yeah.
Do you have an opinion on that?
You know what? I think that's interesting. I've heard a little bit about these Ayurvedic principles. And I think that is interesting because a lot of times people turn to meat, right, for dinner. And I don't know so much of the research here, I will be honest. But I will say, I think one of the things that you can do is do like a plant-based meal at least once a week. Or if that is a principle that you do want to try out, like try meat at lunch. I do think that although I'm not necessarily pro-veganism or plant-based, I think it works for some people. I do think we can all benefit from having more plant-based meals and more plants, for sure.
With you on that, yeah. I think also here we can fall back to the easy wisdom of deferring to your gut and the way you feel. And if you eat a big meal and you wake up in the middle of the night with meat sweats or not feeling great, it's probably a sign that your body doesn't like that and to try something else.
Yes, exactly. And I think with Ayurveda, there is some interesting principles depending on which one you have, like the Vata, I know that's mine, that I think there are some recommendations on which meals work best for you. Like some people, and I know this tends to be a default, that actually having your bigger meal around lunchtime rather than late at night. We oftentimes in our culture, we think dinner has to be the biggest meal, but having more nutrients earlier in the day. And that means if you are someone who does, I tell people consistent meal timing is important. That doesn't mean you can't have snacks though. Just see if you can get it on a schedule. Maybe you're someone like me, for example, I am much more hungry earlier in the day. So I have a breakfast, a small midday brunch snack, a lunch, an afternoon snack, and then I find I'm so much less likely to eat at night. And I've actually kind of gotten on that schedule. And I think that is helpful because then your digestive system is kind of used to this rhythm or this clock. It's almost like your circadian rhythms for sleep. We have these rhythms when it comes to digestion as well.
Yeah, and those are also aligned with the circadian rhythm.
Yeah.
What would you say is the number one thing you've changed your stance on in the last year?
I wouldn't say like I've completely done a flip-flop. I've just continually redefined how I look at this, and it's intuitive eating. So I consider myself an advocate for intuitive eating. A lot of the things that we're talking about, listen to your body, see how you feel, right? Take time to adjust and create schedules and routines and habits that work for you, not necessarily based on what science or some research study or even some coach or specialist that you heard like advocates for, right? Like if you follow someone and you admire them and they're vegan, that's fantastic, but just know that might not work for you. And I think what I had to change my perspective on this is because there's this culture where we don't eat intuitively, right? We're just consistently like, basically influenced by the media and what is in our general area, right? And we're not actually listening to our body and the fact that we might have food sensitivities and we might need to eat cleaner. But I also think there are some intuitive eating advocates who are very much like, eat whatever you want. And like, I think that's more listening to your head rather than listening to your body. So for example, if I like went on that principle of like, listen to what you want, eat whatever you want, I would be eating sugar all the time because I have the biggest sweet tooth. Instead, I have to listen to my body and physically realize that I get a lot of digestive upset when I have those things. And I think it's honoring your body and honoring like your yeses and nos and no-goes, right? Like I honor the fact that gluten just is a no-go for me, right? But I listen to my body and sometimes I eat more meat. Sometimes I eat more plant-based. Maybe it's based on the season. Maybe for women, it's based on your cycle. Listen to those things. But I think it's also honoring what you do need to do for your health and not just throwing the rules out the window. I think some intuitive eating is like, no food rules. But I like to think that you just have to find those rules, quote unquote, these guidelines that work best for you and recognize they can change throughout your life. They're not dogma, right?
If your intuition is telling you to go out and binge on a bunch of junk food, it's probably not your actual intuition. It's your ego or some other part of you that wants to hear that.
Yes, so. I think that's exactly what it is. It's our ego. It's that part of our brain that is just attached to things via nostalgia or memories, right? Like that's why we're addicted to foods, right? It does. There is this like chemical pathway that's happened in our brain. I've always, you know, had cake and ice cream when I was celebrating. So now I feel like I need that whenever anything good happens, right? Or every time I'm sad, I turn to chocolate. And it's just a wiring within your brain and not actually intuition, which I do believe that intuitive feeling is kind of housed within the gut there.
If people want extra tips or they want to understand how they can figure out what their body really wants, you run a Feel Good Gut program. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So my Feel Good Gut programs are my one-on-one coaching programs. I have different levels for different finances and time investments from 30 days to 6 months. And basically my principles behind this Feel Good Gut system are mind, body, and wellness. So what I think is the body is the bulk of it. This is creating the habits, the nutrition that works for you. It's this process of trial and error, finding what works and really kind of healing and listening to the body. But I like to really throw a lot of mindset work in here because if you're making a lifestyle change, which is most of my coaching program, it's lifestyle changes. And I'll make recommendations to see a practitioner if need be. I don't prescribe any supplements or medications or anything of that nature. So I would make referrals if need be. But anytime you make a lifestyle change, it's going to be stressful. It's going to be hard. So really working on how can we be as mindful about this as possible? How can we actually touch into our intuition and not our ego and not our brain? And how can we work on stress management and all of those things? And then that last component of wellness is just finding ways to build this as a habit that you can integrate into every area of your life. I come from a background of health, nutrition, and life coaching. So I do like to look at like relationships and career. And if you are someone who has, you know, barriers here, let's work around this because I don't want your family life or your career or passions to get in the way of this. We want to be able to integrate this so we can be healthy and well and basically make lasting changes. I don't want you to have to keep going back to doctors. I want this to be a lifestyle change, really a solution, hopefully for the long run for you.
And without understanding the relationships and the career, it's hard to give good recommendations and be an effective coach. So it's refreshing to hear that you incorporate everything into your coaching.
Yeah, I'm glad you have that perspective as well. I think that sometimes, and you've mentioned this and I resonate, we can get stressed about our stress management and about our nutrition and our health. Like I know I've been in that state. I've been stressed over food and diet, and I've been stressed over the fact that I need to journal and do yoga and walk and work out and all these things. And it's like, you know, if that is interfering with my life or I'm not actually addressing being unhealthy in a career or relationship, regardless of all these things, those are kind of going to be band-aids if we don't actually address those areas of our life. That's my perspective anyway.
Totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I do have one last question for you, but before I ask, where can those that are interested connect with you online?
Absolutely. You can visit my website. It's healthcoachingbytrish.com. You'll see all my social links there. I do use Instagram the most. I'm at Feel Good Gut Girl on Instagram. If you're on Facebook, my page is Health Coaching by Trish, but I also do have a private group, the Feel Good Gut group, which I do a lot more trainings and conversations and things of this nature. And if you like some of these, informational and informative tidbits, I do have a podcast of my own that I co-host with my friend. It is called Ice Cream You Scream. I am the lactose intolerant health coach. He's my friend, the kind of regular guy who's an ice cream aficionado. And we kind of break down the myths and the truth around different health topics. And we're conversational. We add some humor to it. So you can find Ice Cream You Scream on really any podcasting platform.
And on to the last question. So imagine that there's a worldwide burning of the books and all informational content on Earth is gone. You get to save to bring back three pieces. It can be books, podcasts, your own podcast, movies, videos, you name it.
So I think this is such an interesting, fun question. I love these questions because I love to hear people's answers, but I have to preface by saying I'm so bad at favorites because I feel like my answer could change in like 2 weeks. But when I was thinking about this question, I have three kind of teachers or people that I think would kind of tick off different boxes for me if I had to encapsulate it. When you brought up my own podcast, I do like to listen to it, but I won't say that. One is the general teachings of Dr. Vincent Pedre. He's a gut health doctor. There's quite a few that I look to for inspiration, but I just kind of like his vibe and his personality. He's, I just feel like kind of down to earth. So to get my gut health and health fix, I'd probably have the teachings of Dr. Pedre. To get my, personal development and kind of psychology and sociology, I would look to the teaching of Brené Brown. And I can't choose one of her books or like her TED talk, but I think she also has a good sense of humor and she makes me think. It's very much personal development. So she'd be my person there. And then the last one, I'm not sure if you've ever heard of her. She's Adrienne Mishler. She has a YouTube channel called Yoga with Adrienne. I think she's one of the biggest yoga people out there. And I put that in there because I'm like, I guess if there's a worldwide burning of the books and things, I would at least need my yoga for my mental wellness, my emotional wellness, my physical health. And again, I think she's funny and she's down to earth. And I think there's little snippets of wisdom in her yoga practices as well. So that's my last choice.
Those all sound like good choices, and all of the links to these will be in the show notes. Awesome. Trish, you're a wealth of information on gut health, change psychology, and I'm sure that listeners will get a lot out of this.
Awesome. I think so too. Thank you so much for having me, Nick. This was really fun, good conversation, and I just appreciate it.
My pleasure. Until next time.
I hope that this has been helpful for you. If you enjoyed it, subscribe and hit the thumbs up. I love knowing who's in the 1% committed to reaching their full potential. Comment 1% below so that I know who you are. For all the resources and links, meet me on my website at mindbodypeak.com. I appreciate you and look forward to connecting with you. As a reminder, the information depicted in this video is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.